This is fun! The FU Network!
It's time once again for the Broken Clock Podcast, and I know you guys are pumped for this one. Your anti-quarantine attitudes are not logical. COVID-19 measures are starting to ease, resulting in an epidemic of stupidity. Just yesterday, before we recorded this, 10,000 people crammed into a park called Trinity Bellwoods Park in downtown Toronto, and we've all seen the news about the ongoing court challenges and protests against government measures. Now, okay, while dissent in general is important to a democracy, these arguments put forward by these, I call them coronavirus deniers, they're terrible. They center on circular reasoning, appeals to authority and emotion. So, Mouse Mary, Jess, and I are here to discuss, among other things, the concept of just because you can, not because you should. Now, before I open it up to Mouse, I want to be really clear. We're not going to discuss the constitutionality of specific lockdown orders. That's just too hard because we're talking across two different countries and the lockdown orders are differing state to state. So this is a critical thinking podcast. So we're going to talk about whether people's current behavior makes sense, not whether the behavior is legal. And Mouse, that's why I wanted to start on the idea of just because you can doesn't mean you should. Because I had a very eye-opening conversation with somebody who tends to travel in, we'll say, religious circles, sort of that very hardcore American Christian circles. And it really contextualized sort of the issue, the disagreement here. And I want you to tell me if you've seen this observation as well. At the core of this debate surrounding quarantine, shelter in place, stay at home, lockdown, whatever you want to call it, is basically people sorted into two main groups. One group thinks, we don't know enough about this virus. We don't quite know how it transmits asymptomatically, if it truly does. We seem to think more and more it can. We don't know how to treat it. You know, we don't have a vaccine. So let's err on the side of caution and minimize movement, minimize contact between people until we know more and we have treatments. Then there's the other side that believes, we don't know. We can't say for certain. So let's proceed as normal until we do know. And those seem to be the people who are insisting we have to open up the economy. Now, Mouse, if I'm not wrong, that's the sort of thinking that got us into trouble in the first place, isn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly the attitude that the White House took concerning handling the virus. We have people who, here's the thing. When we're dealing with an unknown, I had to take a sip of my Lacroix so I could be perfectly pedantic.
Right.
When we're facing an unknown threat, we're facing one of a biological nature,
right.
In this case, viral. It is simply common sense to act with caution because it is an incredibly ignorant stance to say, well, we don't know enough about it. We should act as normal. Just from a simple risk cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
Well, we have seen in the past, we have seen an attitude of, well, we don't know how this is transmitted. We should continue life as normal until we know more. And of course, some people might say, I'm talking about some SARS. I'm talking about the AIDS epidemic.
Yes.
We know now what the cost of ignoring that disease was. And I'm not just, we have an entire population that the government ignored as far as being struck with, you know, being particularly prey to this virus.
Mm-hmm.
But it has affected everyone. So if you want to ask yourself, is this a logical stance? Just look at how many lives could have been prevented during the AIDS epidemic. Had one, the government taken it seriously. Had two, people taken it seriously because people at that time were also dismissing it as, oh, it only hits the gays.
Right.
We don't need to wear protection because this is the gay cancer.
Yeah, it was summarized as some sort of moral punishment instead of a virus, a disease, and mm-hmm. viruses don't care about your feelings.
Exactly.
Yeah, that maybe I'd be interested to see how attitudes correlate between people who cared very much about the early days of AIDS and HIV and the people who thought it was some sort of gay plague or punishment from God or something like that, because I'm hearing a lot of similar magical thinking mm-hmm. about COVID-19 that people are some people are just freaking out because they can't attend in-person church services. And meanwhile, I was talking to my friend who's a youth pastor yesterday, and they went video, they went streaming or pre-produced uploaded sermons every week. And I said to him, now that we up here in Ontario, you're now allowed to have church services in the parking lot in your cars. And I said, are you going to do parking lot church? And he said, well, one, no, because we'd have to be out there. And if everybody's got their car idling because they want to run their air conditioning, mm-hmm. that's not going to smell very good to me. But he said also, he says, we're going to keep these videos going even after COVID's done because our reach is up 350%. This is a man of faith who continues to engage in critical thinking.
Yes.
And this is why this person is my friend. He's like, we're in no hurry to get back to normal because the changes we made because of this helped things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's not one of these people who are afraid of the virus. He's, you know, him and his wife and kids are out. They're out in nature. They're going for walks. They're doing the little, like, from the road, like car visits, you know, they come and talk to people, but they stay outside kind of thing. They're being active. They're still maintaining some sort of socialization because it's part of his job, but he's not being an idiot about it. And it always stuns me when people claim to be of faith and yet they ignore the central tenets of faith, which is sort of, faith is sort of a guidebook to make you a better person and allow the world to be better than the way you left it if you follow these tenets. You know, that's what many people of faith believe. It seems like too many people, though, use religion as a sort of Jordan Peterson style taming the chaos. That it's just like D&D core rules, that the self-soothing activity is not the ethics of compassion or, you know, sort of some sort of higher state. It's just, I have rules, so I don't have to think. This book is going to give me a sort of prescription for every occasion. And that's just not how theology works.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're sort of in this logic loop hang. And because of the ability to really figure out what's going on, and they're still suppressing huge amounts of fear, they just jump to the next sort of, script programming that they have, which is blame the government, right?
Uh-huh.
And that we're not, and this is what struck me talking to this gentleman, and I want to be clear, the attitude, he linked me to an article that I saw the circular reasoning in it immediately. This is the problem where we get most of our ideas from op-ed. And this sounds like a bit of a subject change, but I realized that this is directly connected to why some people are so damn illogical about coronavirus. It's the very structure of how we receive our news. Because there's very little traditional hard news anymore that gets shared, right? The W5H, report both sides, use the facts to show which side or the other you know, has the facts on their side. More and more what's shared is opinion columns based on that reporting. So we don't get unfiltered information anymore. We get information presented not in a way that necessarily is rational, reasonable, or appropriately logical, but we get things presented to persuade. And we would all like to think that the most persuasive thing out there is logic, but it's not. No. The reason we have to be so aware of these logical fallacies is because they are persuasive. You know, appeals to authority are very persuasive. The idea, well, a doctor said this. And a lot of people, for a lot of people, that's enough because it's a heuristic, right? Like we go to a doctor, right. They're an expert, we take their word for it. But with something like this, the problem is people will cherry pick. Oh, one doctor thinks this isn't a problem. Thousands of other doctors do, but they focus on the one doctor that doesn't think this is a problem. That's the problem with appeals to authority, You know? And we've got a lot of that. I've seen a lot of people sharing quote unquote articles that are clearly op-ed. And there's nothing wrong with that if you're taking them for what they are. It's, oh, this is an interesting perspective on things. But if you find yourself consuming an op-ed piece as if it's fact, that's where the problem begins.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're
big
they're
problem.
Not. Yeah, they're not. They cherry pick evidence to support their claim. I remember being driven crazy in school regarding op-ed writing. Because I mean, I took writing, and it was all about being, you know, stating things strongly and, you know, making your point, being that was the way it was considered good writing back then. Points said forcefully, you know? And I was like, I don't want to pick a side and just argue that side. This isn't debate practice, right?
Right.
There's a place and time for that as an exercise. But when you're exploring an issue, you should be able to factor in nuance and be able to say, I don't know. And I sat in writing classes and I had, you know, these workshops and like that strong writing where it was considered a bad thing to say, I don't know. And I think the minute, like we talk about certainty all the time and a lack thereof, but you know, the minute you're forced to seem certain or your argument is invalid, we start getting into trouble logically. And that seems to be where the whole world is right now because of the business model of, you know, partisan cable news and partisan websites and now even partisan newspapers, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And we come up against this a lot, but I think we're both in agreement, but I want to check this out because I just wanted a whole thing about not being sure. I want to make sure I'm sure on this. It's one thing when we're debating the merits of a politician because, you know, one politician goes, another one comes along, like wait 5 minutes, right?
Uh-huh.
But when we're talking about a disease that is killing a sizable number of people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah.
Yes, the largest cohort is, you know, 65 and up or 60 and up, but it is taking the lives of much younger people. I think we can all agree this is not our regularly scheduled programming.
Uh-huh.
And yet people seem unable to snap out of the partisan tribalism to solve the problem. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
Because it really seems like attitudes on coronavirus really correlate with your sort of political affiliation. Not across the board, but... You know, I've seen many, many things that show that if you're, say, a Trump supporter, you're less likely to believe it's real. You're more likely to believe in this, you know, plandemic stuff. Though, man, it's really funny the number of hardcore card-carrying, like, Bernie bro types in California that all of a sudden insist that they need to be able to work and this sort of collective response to the virus is just wrong. I'm not sure it really surprised me because I think fewer people. I think there were a lot of people that didn't really subscribe to Bernie Sanders' message so mm-hmm. much as to quote, you know, the great philosopher Stimpy the Cat from Ren and Stimpy. Hey, Ren, I want to yell the loud, funny words, you know? And I think, you know what I mean? Like, I think we're sort of seeing proof positive here.
Yes.
The minute they had the opportunity to become good collectivists, you know, they shit the bed. And here we are, we tend to argue individuality. We tend to, you know, sort of argue that the individual is the entity that truly matters, not the collective. Mm-hmm. But here we are arguing sort of the collectivist approach, because in this case, it happens to be the approach that best benefits the individual.
And I wouldn't necessarily call it the collectivist approach, as because here's the thing, actually. You might say that the camp of Trump and the economy are the collectivist approach, because we are essentially, well, certain people are essentially subjugating the individual and the individual's life to a collective entity known as the economy.
Right.
In which case, the good of the economy is above the good of the participating individuals.
Or the participating corporate entities.
And yeah.
Yeah, that's what's so strange about this whole thing. They want businesses to open when people are afraid to patronize those businesses. Mm-hmm. It costs more money to be open and have no customers than it does to just be closed.
Exactly.
And yet, this is the alleged capitalist response.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's face it, the Republican Party response has not been truly capitalist. I don't know, ever. But, you know.
Especially, it started going super downhill when the man whom they hail as the savior of the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan is the man who opened the doors to the moral majority and the religious right, which started spelling the end of the Republican Party.
Yeah, because they couldn't quit while they were ahead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it, this is just background for some people who may not know this. Reagan's people, let's face it, it wasn't Reagan. Ronald Reagan had gay friends. You know, I really think if it, like, that's the killer, going back to the AIDS epidemic, right? Like, Ronald Reagan personally was fine with gay people. They were friends with Rock Hudson, for God's sakes, right?
Right.
But they had so engaged the religious right that his people thought it would be the kiss of death for him to even say the word gay in public. To this day, I wonder if that's because he did have gay friends and his strategists thought that was a vulnerability.
Well, you know, he was an actor in Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, you know, who, ironically enough, he was the head of the Screen Actors Guild, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe so.
Like, that's a union. Reagan was an interesting, complex person. Ronald Reagan is an example of how simple and wrong can be really persuasive and really compelling, and in a lot of ways, very likable. But nuanced, complex, and right tends to get you better results long term. And the problem with the simplicity of the whole Morning in America thing that Republicans have tried to duplicate, you know, going forward, I think without the same amount of success, just because they didn't come by it honestly, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Reagan was very simple. He believed that he was a figurehead more than anything. He showed up, he was in the office by 9:30 every day and didn't do much, but he hit his marks, right?
Right.
And he that was sort of his philosophy of the presidency. Republicans since then have felt far more activist in terms of what they want to accomplish, just because they want a sort of, they want to create a system of government. And this ties back into the coronavirus thing. I swear to God, guys, like, follow me here. They want to create a system of government that is one giant appeal to authority that constantly begs the question, mm-hmm. right? They want to stack the courts with so many judges, and they want to gerrymander to the point that they have a definite ongoing lock on the Senate. They had to screw up so badly before they lost Congress, but they want a system where they can say, we think this is wrong. Like, they've given up on gay marriage because they realize that gay men are willing, with, you know, sort of the toxic hypermasculinity, to ally themselves with the Republican Party. White gay men, anyway. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they want to be able, on issues like abortion, on issues like corporatism and cronyism, they want to be able to say abortion is wrong because we say it's wrong. And look, a judge that we appointed believes it's wrong. Therefore, it's wrong. There's like, I think every sentence fragment I said there was a separate logical fallacy.
Yeah.
But that's the world they want. At least that's the America they want, because it's power. It's an Orwellian form of power. It's precisely the kind of power that George Orwell constantly cautioned against with his anti-fascist, anti-authoritarian writing. Truly anti-fascist, by the way. Mm-hmm. We're partially in that world in the US right now. They keep trying in Canada, but it doesn't work as well. And I'm not quite sure why, I admit. Like, none of the theories quite connect. You know, we could say it is our stronger public education system, but not so much. There's just something, I think it's because we have healthier immigration. Personally, that's my crackpot theory. But because we get people that come in and they bring their own mind with them, you know. But mm-hmm. in the US, it's become so, take the marching orders, take the talking points, don't question them because you don't want to ally yourself with the evil other guy. And everything comes from that sort of basic structure.
Yeah.
And that's the part that really worries me. And I don't think Americans are any stupider than any other people out there. And I think, you know, 80%, and I'm being kind here, 80% of everybody is half a moron. leaving a large portion for people who are complete morons. But something structural is going on in America that, and I go back to where I began with this. America is so collectively fixated right now on what you can do that it has lost sight of what you should do. And the whole purpose of the American system, the whole purpose of liberty, is we want as many can-dos as possible to be available, so the individual can choose what they should do. That was my understanding of the philosophy of the entire system, right?
Right.
We're so far from that in the debate that it's kind of scary. It's actually very scary.
Well, this is something actually, it's kind of funny. Well, not that funny.
But funny strange, not funny haha.
Yeah, it's funny yeah. strange yeah. In that, so, take a shot.
Okay.
This is something that correlates to an observation that Ayn Rand made concerning the problems that the Libertarian Party in the United States had.
Right.
And I think, I do believe that a good amount of the issues that we're seeing right now are being, well, first of all, are influenced by the Libertarian Party.
Interesting. Okay.
Even it's kind of funny because that is about as much as the Libertarian Party has influenced. because unfortunately, the tenets of the Libertarian Party are completely antagonistic to the tenets of the Republican Party, because it means that you cannot legislate religion into law.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, the new breed of Republicans is very much a creature of pragmatism. And by pragmatism, I mean the kind of person, the kind of voter, the kind of individual who will gladly let go of principle insofar as they can get a benefit.
Right. Right. Political,
social benefit, etc. And so they have fixated on another mercenary, Rand Paul, who is libertarian in name only.
Oh, in action, he's the exact opposite of a libertarian. Yeah. He loves telling other people what to do.
Yeah, he and his father are the greatest frauds that have ever walked under the libertarian flag.
Are they really frauds, though? Or are they trolls, in a way? It's almost like they're challenging people to call them out on their utter doublethink bullshit.
See, that's hard. I honestly don't. See, that's giving them a certain level of the benefit of the doubt that I don't think they deserve.
Yeah, you're right. They're either, I can't figure out whether the Pauls are Ron and Rand, are really dumb people who just won the genetic lottery and so they're extremely privileged. Like, they just don't question anything. They just parrot. You know, they have Germanic roots. It's possible. That was a joke. I had to stick it in there because this is just so like, ah. Or they're there to invoke the cliche, playing six-dimensional chess. They are so calculating in that, how do I put this? They know that the way to sell authoritarian fascism to the public, to the you know, the sort of populist groups, is to take that authoritarianism, take that fascism, and wrap it in a bow that says liberty and freedom.
Exactly.
Like, as long as you say it's for liberty, people won't question if you're right. They focus so much on the intent and not if, in fact, what you're prescribing actually gets us there.
And that's the great power and the great wrong that the Libertarian Party has. It's the only power they have at this point right now.
That's really interesting.
Because they have, here's the thing, you had the Tea Party movement, which started off as a bit of a grassroots libertarian movement.
Yeah. Yeah, I know a couple people who are Tea Partiers. They're fine people.
And then what happened is that the Tea Party movement got the attention of the new breed of Republicans.
And they co-opted it. Yeah.
Saw this as an excellent way to get people on board the more populist side of things. Because here's the thing. And this is the problem that Ayn Rand observed with the Libertarian Party and its philosophy. Take a hit, because I just... Ayn Rand observed, and she had a long arguments with Murray Rothbard and all of the important libertarians at the moment. And of course, she had disagreements. She disagreed vehemently with their approach. And she said this, that the Libertarian Party's greatest problem and what would eventually be its undoing is the fact that as a political party and as a political movement, they lacked a philosophical approach, a sound philosophical approach, because they upheld liberty as an axiomatic truth. And they did not in any factor make any movements towards establishing why is liberty necessary. Where does liberty come from? In her philosophy, she went further. She went into metaphysics. The Libertarian Party never did that. They never actually adopted a philosophical stance that says liberty is, you know, liberty. For example, they could have said liberty is a necessary condition for man and women to be able to thrive and to be able to express and take control of their lives. And this is a metaphysical necessity that comes from the metaphysical nature of what being a sapient human being is. They have never done that. And
no.
so So, of course, you have liberty as this kind of all-purpose word. And
yeah, it's a MacGuffin almost. It's a MacGuffin. Now.
And you have this umbrella that is the Libertarian Party, where you have people who are anarcho-capitalists,
right.
who are socialist libertarian,
right.
who are uber religious, and
yes.
who believe that all sorts of things. They believe that liberty is given to you by God, or that liberty liberty is nothing more than the way by which the strong can dictate the direction of a society, in this case.
Starting to sound a lot like Karl Marx right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the problem in and of itself with the Libertarian Party is that it is philosophically rudderless. And the problem with the rudderless ship is that any person with enough initiative can climb aboard and take control. And that is what, insofar as the Republicans have taken some of the rhetoric of the Libertarian Party, has happened. That is where Rand Paul and Ron Paul come in.
Yeah.
And that is where the whole, I was born in a free country, I should not have to wear a mask party comes in, because now that liberty has become a fetish word, it is
yes.
now, it has lost its common, it has lost its philosophical backing, its philosophical grounding in the collective imagination. It has become this religious fetish word that
because let's face it, from a political perspective, if you start defining liberty, you might make someone feel bad, Mouse. You might make someone question one of these things. I mean, let's face it, but let's be clear, the left has the exact same issues
mm-hmm.
from different roots. But you get with the, you know, you go with the right and it's like, well, where does liberty come from? Half, you know, most of their voters will say, well, God. And, you know, most of the leaders will go, the markets, I mean, you're right, God.
Yeah.
You know, you start to get, because let's face it, these guys, they like to thump the Bible because they don't want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of good stuff in the Bible, but that might make them second guess their power for power's sake, consolidation of artificial wealth, right? Mm-hmm. Not through true capitalistic means, but through very, very real state control of the markets.
And politics of pull.
Yes. Now you get over to the left and what is liberty? And oh man, that becomes a real mess, right?
Yes.
Because then you get some people saying, well, liberty is the, you know, absolute, like, elimination of poverty. Other people say liberty is a quality of opportunity to not be judged by the color of your skin, but the content of your character.
Mm-hmm.
Other people say liberty is my ability to be able to ascend through the various socioeconomic classes. And so one day a person like me can hold power. And those three groups hate each other. They just do. I mean, the group that insists that eliminating poverty is true liberty is completely at odds with the people that say, no, upward social mobility is true liberty, because upward social mobility requires an underclass. And instead of going, and this is where the, you know, the left could, and the left in Canada has done a fairly good job with this, though they keep getting derailed periodically. It's like, look, there has to be relative poverty, not absolute poverty. There are certain true essentials in life that everybody has a right to. We should make sure they are provided with that somehow. However, that's the bottom rung. Everybody isn't going to be on the bottom rung. There have to be, you know, there are going to be striations. There are going to be people who are more comfortable. The, you know, the middle ground is that it just makes more sense. Everything's cheaper when everybody has a baseline standard of living. That, though, offends the hard left that thinks that, no, any sort of socioeconomic striations are inherently anti-liberty. because that means we go, both sides end up at the you think you're better than me place. You know, and you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez complaining about the cost of croissants at the airport. You know, terrible argument, just terrible.
I know.
Like, it's the airport. They gouge everybody. This is hardly the indication of a standard of living with somebody living in Inglewood, California, you know?
Yeah.
This isn't food deserts, woman.
She disappoints me a lot because she is very intelligent, but she has drank so much of the Kool-Aid.
Okay, let's face it. She's 29.
She
might be 30 now.
That's true. I forget how young she is because I always think she's older just because of how she conducts herself.
Yeah, I mean, I think people like her are sort of the example of who we need to reach in order for decision makings at the high level to become more rational, because mm-hmm. she is clearly extremely intelligent.
Oh yeah.
She is driven. She is ambitious. And unfortunately, a particular political affiliation got to her first. And I can only imagine her walking in on the first day when the new Congress was in session and Nancy Pelosi going, "Oh, child, you'll learn."
Here's the thing. And the problem right now with the political landscape is, well, yeah, that faction got to her first. The problem is, can you imagine, I can imagine just the horror show if, say, the libertarians had gotten to her. Because then she would be another Rand Paul.
Well, she'd be even more powerful, though, because she's Latino. Yes. Fortunately, her lived experience insulates her from that kind of magical thinking. Mm-hmm. But this is the important thing for everyone to realize. And this is why this hard, you know, Venn diagram of two circles side by side, no overlap in terms of the idea of critical theory and lived experience. The one thing about lived experience, it's valid, but you have to recognize what, you know, magical thinking your personal lived experience makes you fall prey to. Mm-hmm. And I realized this when I was in university, which no one does. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I realized I was being less, I was thinking less critically of thinking that validated me, told me that various elements of my struggle were not my fault, and dismissing the stuff that I'm just like, no, that makes me feel bad. That makes me feel blamed. And, you know, it became, because I was able to continue to engage despite that, I very quickly realized that, you know, some of those things that I just immediately rejected because they made me feel bad were actually right. Now, most people don't take that step, right? And I mean, poverty and watching one's parents struggle, that's a major life-defining thing. And we have to be able to have some common ground in terms of struggle is good for you, but there are limits, mm-hmm. right? You know, in a country as wealthy as the United States and Canada, and I mean, Mexico will be there in 10, 20 years, people shouldn't be going hungry. You know, basic things like food and shelter and primary medical care, those things should kind of be covered.
And there's also another problem that assails a country like the United States, and it's the fact that the longer it stays away from becoming a capitalist country, the longer people are not going to be able to reach a certain level of prosperity. Because here's the thing. Sure, you can say, oh yeah, you can start your business. Well, have you looked at the cost of starting your own business? And I'm not talking about the costs that are inherent in starting a business, such as, you know, you have to buy the equipment, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at the cost of, you know, paying your local bureaucrats for the privilege
right.
of working.
And or even the initial investment.
Yeah.
Like, it's bizarre that I look at Canada's systems, not our rhetoric, right? Like, mm-hmm. not what we believe about ourselves, but what our systems actually do. And Canada is so much more capitalist than the United States right now.
Yeah.
And you can't talk about, like, when you start bringing this up, a lot of people in, like, the center left go, shh. Because we got a good thing going here, and we don't want to ruin it. Yeah. But the big difference between Canada and the U.S. is Canada recognizes that, yeah, starting a business is expensive. But in order to get people to risk, and risk is required for capitalism to flourish, the risks have to be calculated risks, not insane risks, right? Because if people take insane risks and keep losing their shirt, then we have a poverty problem. We have a debt problem, all that stuff. So mitigate the risk, right? Make there be some risk, but not unbearable risk. Make there be some cost, but not insurmountable cost. And moving over to the COVID-19 stuff, you see it in the responses. And this is part of the reason I wanted to do this topic. Because I came across an article that I thought was going to be one of those, here we go, lockdowns are unconstitutional and all that stuff. And they were arguing that, but in a unique way that I actually found persuasive. And I realized that this is the big difference between the Canadian model and the US model. They claimed that the unconstitutionality was that these various governments shut everything down without providing things like food and medicine. And I realized, oh my God, that's the difference between authoritarianism and capitalism, right? Like up here, the government's basically paying people to stay home. People are providing a service, staying home. The government is paying for that service. That's capitalism, right?
Right. And if you remember, Justin Amash, who announced that he was not running for president, the reason he opposed the stimulus checks, of course, he was vilified for that, but I found his reasoning to make sense. He opposed the legislation as it was because he said this provides no relief and no help for Americans in the middle of a pandemic was mismanaged by the government.
Yeah.
And he said, we should be giving people money monthly, not a one-time stimulus check.
Which is what they do here.
So, like, again, you know, Justin Amash, see, here's an interesting thing, because people will say, well, libertarians are against government aid. That is not entirely true.
That is the position a lot of alleged libertarians in the Republican Party make. That is not mm-hmm. a libertarian perspective. So go on. I want to be clear because people are going to be but. No, I'm getting on ahead. Go on because I like where you're going with this.
And here's the thing. You might say, well, yes, that is actually the libertarian position, but they're omitting one thing. Ethics.
Yes.
Morality and all of those things are not absolute. They are contextual. And this is a problem with the Republican Party. Because the Republican Party, as a religiously backed party, which it is, mm-hmm. it is an absolutist party.
Yes.
They are completely inflexible, and they are unwilling to recognize or implement any potential solution that might, at first glance, prima facie, go outside of its boundaries. Mm-hmm. But what Justin Amash did is he applied principle to a situation. And he said, you know, even though I do not believe the government should be a paternalistic state on the regular, this constitutes an emergency. This mm-hmm. falls under the ethics of emergency. The government itself is responsible for the high death toll because we acted so little and mm-hmm. so late that this has gone completely out of control. It is therefore proper, because the government's main role, and this is me applying the thought of the libertarian principles to the situation, it is proper therefore for the government, because its main role, the main role of a government, is to protect its citizens.
Yep.
to provide aid and relief and incentive to keep these citizens safe because we screwed the pooch, we shat the bed.
Yeah, and I looked this up actually. The Constitution doesn't say that the government has the power to basically quarantine to prevent diseases, the spread and introduction of disease, the introduction and spread, sorry, of diseases. It says the government has the responsibility to do it.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. So when I applied for my green card, one of the things I had to do was to submit myself to a complete physical.
Yeah.
Because part of the immigration rules and restrictions are to ensure that the immigrant who is coming into the country does not carry an infectious disease that could be easily
There are specifically listed diseases in that too. Things like cholera, tuberculosis, and severe acute respiratory infections. And yet, you know, I go back to this appeal to authority thing. Part of the reason I think some of these, you know, hardcore right wingers are funding some of these protests is they think they're never going to get a better chance through the courts to establish precedent, to establish some case law. The thing about quarantines right now is the law is very amorphous. It's never really been challenged other than mental health confinement. So the truth is, all these people yelling, it's not constitutional or it is constitutional. In fact, we don't know. It's never been tested. And I think that, you know, the Republicans are pushing now because, well, they're never going to get a better shot. Once again, they're sort of preparing to get wiped out in 2020. I don't think that's a sure thing, but, you know, it is possible.
One can only hope.
Yeah, if they're out in the wilderness for a while, you're going to see, I get it, you're going to see an exodus of older liberal-leaning judges so they can appoint the younger ones who, you know, will stay in there for a while. Everybody's just praying for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to hang on, right?
Gosh, yes. Keep that woman alive.
But it's the lower courts as well, right?
Right.
And people, right-leaning organizations are just taking the shot now. They're taking the swing. And I don't blame them in terms of game theory. It's the right strategy. But it's really telling to me that constitutional law has become what can I get away with as opposed to what you were talking about is, and what the founding fathers I really believe intended was, how can my actions prop up or perpetuate the underlying philosophical principles that inform these laws? That inform our Constitution. And that's the part I really feel very much has been lost, because everything's either become this corporate cronyism or this, you know, Frankfurt School, you know, academic propagandizing. And the problem is, that's, let's face it, anybody with a university degree has been exposed to one or the other or both of these things that are not based on reason, they're not based on logic, they're certainly not based on ethics. And because ethics is considered too political now, too thorny, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to believe one of these utterly ludicrous systems, right?
Right.
It's amazing to me that if you go out and talk to people who are blue collar now, you can have a pretty rational conversation. And I find that blue collar people tend to be like, you know, well, I believe what I believe and they got some funny ideas, but they're all right, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas you get into people with liberal arts degrees and business degrees. And unless they're very successful in business, you will never meet a more open-minded, live and let live person than somebody who is doing very well in business but is still paying off their college debt.
Yes.
those, I just described the only Republicans I still count as friends, because they don't like Trump, but they're also just like, this is what I believe, but I see your point. You know, yeah.
this is what I believe, but things are crazy.
Yeah, like the chill. Anybody else with a college degree, they've had their heads filled with illogic, anti-scientific nonsense.
Yeah, well, because you have this mixture, this unholy mixture, as I like to call it, on the left. You know, most universities are of a left-leaning bent. And they have gone pretty far left in many cases.
At least they claim to be. I'm not sure about that in principle, but go ahead. I'll tell you why I say that.
And then you have got, and then you have the other universities, more private religious universities, that go in the opposite direction, often as a counter-reaction to the left-leaning universities, or at least the left-leaning. There's a difference between the administration and what the faculty is doing.
Yes.
For example. Over here at Boulder, I don't live in Boulder, but Boulder is kind of like people have nicknamed it the People's Republic of Boulder. it's a very, very hard left leaning town. And of course it's incredibly expensive to live there. And all the very, very, very wealthy people live there and impoverished students.
Yes. But isn't that the dichotomy? A lot of university towns tend to be very wealthy surrounding the university.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yes, but you have, and then of course you have the administrators who tend to be more on the conservative side of things.
Yes.
Because money is, you know, a thing.
Yeah. They're looking for rich alumni.
Mm-hmm.
And so for all their left-leaning liberal art stuff, their business, law, and medical schools tend to be quite conservative because that's where they're looking for the wealthy donors from.
Right. And the problem is this. The problem is that universities no longer are what universities were supposed to be.
Yeah.
A university was meant to be, yes, a place of learning, but also a place of debate and exposure.
Yes.
It used to be, and my father told me this, and of course I was completely, when I first came to the United States, I went to a liberal arts college. And of course my father told me that I would be, you know, my ideas would be confronted, that I would experience all sorts of different ideologies, et cetera, and to relish the fact that I was going to basically be in an intellectual joust, and that would eventually make me a better person because I would have to test my ideas. Well, I can tell you that never happened.
I was going to say you were tested all through your life because you were educated by Jesuits, and
yes,
you're very much not. I think your dad missed a big piece of information when he cautioned you with that. Little late, Dad.
Well, my dad went to Loyola University.
Okay.
Before he became Loyola Marymount.
Right.
And, you know, run again by Jesuits.
Yeah.
Here's a funny tidbit. My theology teacher, I came out twice in high school to my Jesuit teachers.
Right.
Once was to my spiritual advisor, and I told him, you know, Father Hugo, I am gay. And he just took a puff from his pipe and said, okay, just don't fall in love with anyone here.
Yeah.
And he said this.
Don't make it my problem.
Well, he said, because your classmates are stupid. he was Argentinian. He had that very, very, very.
man.
And then I came out to my theology teacher, who incidentally was friends with the current Pope.
Oh, wow.
The Pope, when he came to Ecuador, only made one personal stop, and that was to visit my theology teacher.
Father Pedro, wow.
Who has now passed away.
Oh,
but,
yes, yes, yes. Okay, yeah.
We used to call him the Energizer Bunny because he was short, squat, and he walked like the Energizer Bunny. But he was very, very fiercely intellectual. But so I told him, Father, I am an atheist. And he looked at me and he took a sip of his wine because he always was drinking wine. Different cultures, you can tell.
Sensing a theme here. Yeah.
And he said, okay, but you still need to do your homework.
Yeah. But you know what is the right answer?
Yeah. And he knew that I was an atheist, but he also told me this. If you're going to be an atheist, I want you to have a reason and be able to articulate why you don't believe. And so, and he said, and, you know, and it might turn out that you do believe at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But you're not going to know unless you actually know the faith that you are not, that you're disbelieving. So I want you to know these arguments. I want you to know all of this. And he, and I had a special project, basically, at the end of my time at the school, I was to write a paper to him explaining my reasoning for, you know, for being an atheist and using documented, you know, what I considered to be documented evidence,
right,
both from theological and scientific sources. You would not find this kind of approach in any other religious school but the Jesuits.
Yeah.
And it was not a pass-fail type of thing. It was basically him saying it was not graded, but he wanted to know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good teaching. That's the kind of stuff that you can't do anymore because everything is so controlled by the highest levels, you know, Department of Education and state boards. They don't allow teachers to teach anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's all about, and this sort of takes us full circle, because I mentioned off the top the place for healthy dissent versus just people screaming and kicking up a fuss. And I think, unfortunately, what's happened in the modern world now is they got very good, especially in the George W. Bush years, of turning the volume way down on dissent. Like, for people who aren't aware, that was when you started to see, you know, they'd have protest zones and they'd move them way out of the way. So, they were still allowing people to protest, but it wasn't anywhere that anybody could really see.
Yes.
And when you stifle people's ability to do that, it gets worse. It stops being, you know, conscientious objection. And just becomes objections. People just get so used to, I swear there are some people, the only time they feel alive is when they're outraged. Yeah, when they're outraged. Like the number of women who went and put on those pink cat ear hats when Trump got elected and have barely lifted a finger to improve their own communities since then. Some of them ran for office, some of them got involved. But if every single one of the people who are at that protest got meaningfully involved in their local level some way, the entire like Western Hemisphere would look different right now.
Yeah.
And people I've been binge watching Westworld as well. And I'm trying to bring this in for landing because mansplaining has to record after us. But there's like a clobber line in every season. And Westworld is all about using, you know, artificial consciousness to question whether most human beings are in fact conscious or whether most human beings just follow their loops and never question the nature of their reality. And season three ended with Dolores, the Evan Rachel Wood character. And I love that they named the character Dolores because it means sadness, right?
Yes.
But she said, after all her trials and tribulations and struggles, she says, free will does exist. I believe it exists. It's just really fucking hard.
Hard, yes.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's such a blunt instrument line, right? But yes. I really think that the audiences that can afford HBO need to hear that. Free will is hard. And the fact that it was spoken by a woman is was so important, because whether it's Ayn Rand or it's Betty Friedan or, you know, any of these real kind of thinking people, they all kind of came to that same conclusion. Bettering yourself is hard. Free will is hard. Making choices is hard. But what's the alternative? you know? Mm-hmm. The alternative is to never really truly be, if the alternative is not having free will. And I think most people would think they want free will, but most people are not truly willing to do the hard stuff to ensure that they have it. And I, these quarantine protesters, these people that, you know, they're like I said earlier, there's an argument to make about the U.S. government response. Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, an argument that you caused us to do something without appropriate compensation. That is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. But that's not what these protesters are insisting on. They're demanding we should go back to work.
Yeah.
And it's... unfortunately, we live in a paradigm with these businesses where if the various state governments didn't, you know, enforce those stay-at-home orders, people would have been forced to go into work. That bird is very ominous right now. Thank you, bird, for the sound effects. You know, if they hadn't have put those stay-at-home orders in, people would have been forced to go to work and possibly get very, very ill. Mm-hmm. And the numbers would have been much higher. A truly free society would not require these orders because businesses would recognize it is in their best interests
not to kill their
bless our finance minister up here, Bill Morneau, right? In the early days of this whole thing where they were taking shit for throwing money at everybody. Bill Morneau is a very, very smart financier. They bent some, they sort of ignored some ethical issues with him to keep him because mm-hmm. he is very good at what he does.
At what he does.
Yeah. But he said, look, this isn't a question of finding a solution that isn't going to hurt the economy. Everything's going to hurt the economy. But we believe that this is going to cause the least amount of damage mm-hmm. to our economy in the middle and long term because a bunch of people getting sick and either being off work for a very long time or
die,
dying, and businesses going under because they can't get the employees, that, you know, people don't have the money to spend because they're ill, that would be worse. That mm-hmm. would cause more damage to our economy. The recession would be more profound. And that made sense to me. You know, it's like, all right, this sucks. Nobody likes it. Some people do. They're quite happy to sit at home. I would like to know what that's like. I'm one of those people that are on kind of furlough. But, you know, I think it's important. It's important to read and consume things that you disagree with. But it's also very important to question when you agree with something.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And this... the fact that we can't get consensus on an issue that involves people's health with, you're right about this, but, oh, the train of thought. Okay.
Yep.
that's an indication that it's time to wrap. I think this train comes by when we're wrapping because of the time we wrap.
I think so.
That's funny. But, you know, we can't get to the point of, I agree with you here. I agree with you here. I agree with you here. This, you lost me.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we can't do that because people treat disagreement as anathema, it's a problem. It's a problem with our discourse.
And some people also treat dissent for the sake of dissent as a virtue.
And I think this gives me an idea for a topic for next time, but I'll tell you when we're done. Let's wrap Ooh. Now. Because I've been ruminating on a theory of late, and I want to hear what you think about it, but that's for another time. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network. Support us on Patreon, patreon.com/funetwork.tv, or a one-time PayPal donation, or you can visit the store at funetwork.tv, which I understand is going to be getting a bit of an overhaul soon, which is very exciting. But remember, thinking is good for you. even when it hurts sometimes. Oh man, that's been the theme of the episode. Mouse, as usual, you have the last word.
Stay home, stay safe, stay healthy, and for God's sake, think.